We're going to continue with Renovation of Covenants, Part 3. I want to reread the fourth term of communion. Public social covenanting is an ordinance of God, obligatory in churches and nations under the New Testament. That the National Covenant and the Solemn League are an exemplification of this divine institution. That these deeds are of continued obligation upon the moral person. And in consistency with this, that the renovation of these covenants at Alcansas, 1712, was agreeable to the Word of God. We're reading through the preface to the Alcansas renovation and discussing questions relating to the whole doctrine of renovating covenants. I just want to continue to read a little bit more in the preface so that we have some idea of what they were doing, ultimately what they're going to do, and I've mentioned this before and I'll keep mentioning it as we go. They're taking the National Covenant, Psalm League and Covenant, and they're taking out any temporally bound reference, and instead of the King's Majesty's person, they're putting in lawful supreme magistrate. They're doing things like that to adapt the covenant to the time and place. They're observing the spirit of the covenant, but they're avoiding those elements of the covenant which were clearly only going to be aimed at a particular generation. But they're trying to show what elements are binding and how they're binding and how even things which are conditioned by time and locality, how those things can be applicable in a broader context. So what they're doing at Alcansas really is they're giving us a pattern not only for the Church of Scotland renovating or renewing covenant in Scotland, but for how they foresee covenanters handling the covenants in circumstances which are different from those in which they were originally taken. I'm trying to point out the various principles and the various moral abiding parts of this idea of covenanting, what it is they're really striking for in covenanting. The reason I bring that up is as we go through renovating covenants today, we're going to talk about precisely how oaths bind. And we need to look at how things can change and what kinds of things can loose an obligation and why. And so we'll see that one of the things they're doing is recognizing they're not bound to the letter of the law, but they are bound to the spirit of the law, even when the letter is beyond their reach. You know, they've passed beyond the time and even the place, perhaps, where that would be in effect. Nonetheless, they're not saying we have no obligation. They're saying we're still obliged to the spirit of what it was they were doing. And so what is going on in Arkansas has an impact and has had an abiding effect on the way covenanters, wherever they've gone in the world, have perceived themselves. And to the extent that covenanters have adhered to the principles that are set out in this covenant renovation, they've tended to remain faithful both to the principles as well as to the actual contours of this idea of covenanted reformation. To the extent that they've abandoned this, they've tended to abandon the idea of covenanting altogether. They've tended to move away and even demonstrate a certain, not just apathy, but antipathy or hostility to the whole idea of covenanting, even though historically these were groups which were covenanting groups. So Alcansas is really a blueprint for how covenanters ought to conduct themselves in different times and places when they're not the majority party, when they are in fact a dissenting minority, not content to go along with the majority that are in a course of defection. Now, with that in mind, I want to continue reading the preface. These things is not so immediately proper for the work in hand, though natively involved in the doctrine, being only cleared in transition. He, he's talking about John Macmillan, in the second place, more positively, to insist upon and handle the following heads. Number one, more generally, to propose some considerations which make such a great work as renewing covenant with the Lord a weighty, hard, and difficult work. And upon the other hand, to lay down some counterbalancing considerations which render such a work more easy and light and may afford matter of encouragement towards the undertaking of it. Number two, more particularly in application to ourselves and the work in hand, to lay before those who are resolved to enter into covenant with the Lord what were the things that seemed to speak against us in the work and might prove matter of discouragement in the undertaking of it. And what upon the other side might seem to speak for us and be ground of encouragement to us to go forward in humble and sincere endeavors to renew our covenant with the Lord. Together, number three, with some advices and directions to such as were resolved upon the work, as for the first, the consideration which make covenanting work weighty and difficult. The first consideration was drawn from the greatness of the party to be covenanted with, the great and glorious Jehovah, the creator of the ends of the earth, who is a holy and jealous God and will not forgive the iniquity of such as are false-hearted and perfidious in his covenant, obstinately persisting in their false dealing. So Joshua premonishes the people, making very fair resolutions and promises to serve the Lord, that it was a harder work than at first sight they apprehended. That they could not serve the Lord in regard as he is an holy God, he is a jealous God, that would not forgive their transgressions nor their sins, and that if they should forsake the Lord and serve strange gods, then he would turn and do them hurt and consume them after he had done them good. Joshua 24:19-20. Tis a part of his name, Exodus 34:7, that he will by no means clear the obstinately and impenitently guilty. A second consideration that makes the work of covenanting with God to appear a hard and difficult work was taken from the nature of the work itself, which is to serve the Lord in the covenant way and in the capacity of covenanted children. This covenant relation involving in it a walk and conversation in all things like chosen of the Lord. It is no small matter so to walk and so to behave as to be counted worthy of a covenanted union with the Lord and interest in him. This covenant relation being confirmed with such awful sanctions as in Scripture we find in Nehemiah 10:29. They entered into a curse and into an oath to walk in God's law, etc. This consideration, the covenanting work is weighty in its own nature, was further illustrated and amplified from the difficulty both of the things to be engaged against and of the things to be engaged unto. As for the former, the things to be engaged against, which is sin in all its kinds and degrees and in all its inducements to it, both with reference to ourselves and also as to participation in the sins of others, this must first be put away if one would be a right covenanter. Well did old Jacob understand the necessity of this, who being resolved to go up to Bethel to renew his covenant with God, that answered him in the day of his strait, advises his family first to put away the strange gods that were amongst them and to be clean, Genesis 35:28. So David assures us in Psalm 34:14 that departing from evil must precede doing of good. A man that would lift up his face without spot in renewing covenant with God must first put iniquity far away and not suffer wickedness to dwell in his tabernacles. as Zophar advises Job in Job 11, 14, and 15. They that would take on with a new master must be fairly parted from the old. There's no way of pleasing both Christ and Mammon, and therefore no possibility of serving both, whence the nature of covenanting work requires that there be an upright putting away of all sin. For if the soul have any secret reserves in favors of beloved sin, it has no ground to think that Christ will accept it as his covenanted spouse and bride. Nor is this all. Secondly, must be mourned over and truly bewailed, especially upon the account of the offense done to a gracious God thereby, which sorrow must not be of an ordinary sort, but an extraordinary and most intense sorrow. For it cannot be an ordinary kind of sorrow, provided it be in any suitable measure proportioned to the offense. And thirdly, which follows upon the former, there must be a loathing of the person's self because of these its ways and doings that have not been good in his sight. Ezekiel 6:9. Even to the degree as to fill the soul with wonder and astonishment that ever it should have occasion of renewing covenant with God again. Fourthly, there must be a sincere and hearty resolving against all these sins consequent upon this loathing. The soul saying with a steady purpose, if I've done iniquity, I will do so no more. Job 34:32. Secondly, as to the latter, the things engaged unto render the nature of covenanting work difficult and weighty, which are duties of various kinds, such as number one, holiness towards God, which is one special and chief part of the covenant, and that not for time only, but forever, both in regard that God, the party covenanted with, is holy and unchangeably so, and calls his people to imitate him in this attribute especially, and also in regard that the covenant itself is, for its nature, holy, all the articles being morally good and consonant to the royal law, the scriptures of truth, and for the extent of its duration of perpetual force and obligation. This duty of holiness towards God, engaged to in the covenant, comprehends in it a zealous endeavor to maintain the purity of the doctrine, worship, discipline, and government of his institution in opposition to all who would corrupt it or decline from it. Two, righteousness toward our neighbor, and more especially to our covenanted brother, which righteousness should discover it itself both in reference to sin and duty by reproving him for sin or upon his rejecting reproof by withdrawing from him that he may be ashamed and so come to be reclaimed from his evil course and by affording him all that help and assistance to covenanted duties that may be warrantably called for and generally by uprightness towards him in all our transactions and dealings of any kind. Third, faithfulness toward our nation, which comprehends a constant endeavor to advance and promote in our station the common good thereof, and a steadfast opposition to the courses that tend to take away the privileges of the same. Fourth, uprightness toward ourselves in everything relating to the real good of our own souls and bodies by walking in all the duties of soberness, temperance, and moderation. So as others are to have their due, so ourselves are not to be neglected. A third consideration, whereby the duty of renewing covenant with God appears to be difficult and weighty, was deduced from the manner and way of engaging, whereunto several things of great difficulty to be attained were showed to be absolutely necessary. As, number one, judgment, to know and in some measure comprehend the nature of the duties to be engaged to, and the advantages flowing from the right entering into and keeping of the covenant, and the losses redounding to the breakers thereof. Number two, seriousness, which if ever it be an exercise, will certainly then be most lively when the soul is entering upon a work of so high import as making a covenant with God. For then the creature has one of two to look for, either covenant blessings or covenant curses, according as it performs or not performs the tenor of the covenant. Third, Deliberation, rashness in covenanting is of dangerous consequence. It is not an example of others only, nor raw flashes of conviction or love, nor external considerations in gain, honor, men's approbation, etc. It must induce to this duty, but a fixed permanent purpose of heart and soul, rationally and deliberately entering into. 4. Heart integrity. It'll be done with all the heart. 2 Chronicles 15:15. For the man brings himself under a curse, and having a male in his flock, sacrificeth to the Lord a corrupt thing. Malachi 1:14. Fourth consideration from whence the work of covenanting comes to be a difficult and hard work was deduced from the way and manner of performing the duties engaged to, which is, as 'tis expressed in the covenant, with sincerity, reality, and constancy. Difficulty of attaining to these qualifications in the performance of covenant duties arising partly from the strength of corruption within, the law of sin and death, which opposes the law of God, and partly from the strength of snares and temptations from without, which requires that, as becomes covenanted children, there be a daily recourse to Jesus Christ for light to discover and strength to overcome these corruptions and temptations, and light in life, that the soul turn not dead and insensible under them. A fifth consideration, from whence the difficulty of covenanting with God is sometimes heightened, was taken from the meanness of such as attempt the work, when the great ones, the nobles that are called shields of the earth, do not afford their authority in patrociny as an encouragement to the undertaking. When the wise and learned will not employ their learning, parts, and abilities for the facilitating thereof, but the mean and weakest are left to do the work there alone. This was no small difficulty and discouragement to the Tekoites in their building and repairing the walls of Jerusalem, that their nobles put not their necks to the work of the Lord, Nehemiah 3:4. A sixth consideration, which may sometimes render such a work hard and difficult, was drawn from the want of the concurrence of civil authority and the opposition made thereunto by the laws of the land, which when it happens to be the case of a people designing to renew national engagements, cannot but be very difficult and discouraging ingredient amongst others in their cup. On the other hand, these counterbalancing considerations were adduced, which are so many props and pillars to support the people of God and to allay the difficulties of the duty of entering into covenant with God and make it the more light and easy. 1, that the work is the Lord's and he's greatly concerned in it, therefore his people may safely lean to him for help, he having enacted no law against it as men have. 2, that he looks not upon his people in such undertakings as in themselves, for then it were impossible for creatures, having the least sinful imperfection in them, to covenant with their spotless Creator, and come so near to a jealous God, who is a consuming fire to the workers of iniquity. But he considers his people in their covenanting with him, as in their head Christ, his eternal Son. Whence we may safely say that our national covenant wants not a mediator more than the covenant of grace in this sense, as it is through him that we have access to make this covenant with God. 3, that the Lord has promised his presence to his own work, thus we find through the whole of the covenant made and renewed by the people of Israel and Judah, that the Lord discovered his gracious presence with them by some remarkable effect of his goodness. Thus it is remarked of Hezekiah, that after he entered in covenant, that the Lord was with him, and he prospered whithersoever he went forth. 2 Kings 18:7, compared with 2 Chronicles 29:10. 4, that the Lord puts none of his people to any piece of his work upon their own proper expense and charges, but upon his only. And whatever complaints his people may have of want of necessary charges, he both has wherewith to supply them, and has undertaken to make it actually forthcoming for them, having commanded his people to open their mouth wide, and he's promised to fill it. 5, that the covenant has a greater entail of blessing, and what will sufficiently compensate whatever expense and pains the people may be at in undertaking and performing it. In regard that though a Christian should lose all, yea, even life itself, upon the account of it, yet the covenant will bring in all the with advantage to 100-fold and glory to the overplus when it is duly observed. 6, that the undertakers have God's call and command to set about it. That is, that which above all other considerations inspires a Christian with undaunted courage and alacrity in undertaking of a duty when it is made clear that the person has God's call and command for a warrant. Otherwise, the want of this may make the duty to be heartlessly and doubtingly entered upon and lamely performed. Let's stop there. Okay, we want to look at a few questions again about this idea of renewing of covenant. We see again in Macmillan's sermon, he's trying to address objections and fears that people have, different concerns, and that's what we're trying to do as we go through, trying to be a little bit more systematic, perhaps, than it may appear in the preface, but we're trying to cover the same territory, just bring it into a little bit more focus, perhaps. So the first question we want to undertake is this one. May the covenant universally be imposed upon all ranks and sorts of persons, and may all be admitted to take it? Well, these really are two different questions. The fact is this, that though all members of covenanting societies are under an obligation of it materially, and all are bound to take it formally if they're qualified, yet neither ought it to be imposed, nor should any be admitted, without respect to their capacities, both gracious and legal. And this appears from the following considerations. First of all, the wicked, that is those who are scandalous and obstinate in wickedness, error, profanity, or malignancy, those who hate instruction and cast the Lord's word behind them, do not have God's right in it. Look at Psalm 50, 16 and 17.
Psalm 50, verses 16 and 17. But unto the wicked God saith, what hast thou to do to declare my statutes, or that thou shouldest take my covenant in thy mouth, seeing thou hatest instruction, and castest my words behind thee?
When we talk about an entire society, whether church or state entering into covenant, there is a formal and a material obligation upon everybody in that society. But the fact is this. Those who are obstinately wicked, God himself prohibits from taking. So, although then it ought to be imposed upon all ranks and sorts of persons, that's a very different thing from imposing it on people who are acknowledging that they are not spiritually qualified to enter into this covenant. All right. Second, likewise, those who are legally incapacitated as enemies of truth and godliness, with whom God's people ought not to associate. Look at Exodus 23, 32, 34, 15, Deuteronomy 7, 2, Judges 2, 2, Ezra 4, 3, and 9, 14.
Exodus 23, verse 32. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods.
Exodus 34, verse 15. Lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice.
Deuteronomy 7, verse 2. And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them.
Judges 2, verse 2. And ye shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land, and ye shall throw down their altars. But ye have not obeyed my voice. Why have ye done this?
Ezra 4, verse 3. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua, and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel, said unto them, ye have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God. We ourselves together will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us.
Ezra 9:14. Should we again break thy commandments and join in affinity with the people of these abominations? Wouldest not thou be angry with us till thou hadst consumed us, so that there should be no remnant nor escaping?
The fact is this, there's some people who are unqualified, that are in fact unqualified by their own behavior, and they know it. They ought to confess their error. In fact, the obligation is not lessened for them. They ought to covenant. But it would be a greater violation on the part of the society to impose a covenant on people who are morally deficient in this regard, or spiritually deficient. But likewise, those that we know to be legally incapacitated, people who shouldn't be incorporated into that society, people who are beyond simple acts of immorality or the fact that they are in some way spiritually at a disconnect. We're talking about people who are declared enemies, people with whom the church ought not to associate, a godly people ought not to associate. That's another level altogether. So we want to keep away both the obstinate and scandalous, as well as malignants, people who are set on a course contrary to this position of covenanting. Now, additionally, it's clear from Scripture, though all are bound to it, it's to be imposed upon and tendered to none but those that subscribe to it with choice and resolution. Look at Joshua 24:15-22.
Joshua 24:15-22. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And verse 22, when Joshua said unto the people, ye are witnesses against yourselves that ye have chosen the Lord to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses.
Scripture makes it very clear that although everyone is bound to enter into it, the matter being lawful, good, wholesome, conducive to the glory of God, and so on, and yet none are to be required to subscribe who aren't going to do so willingly. So if you're not willing to do it, it's not that you're outside of the obligation to do it. You are obliged. But we don't want to go around and force people to do it. We don't want to press them into the service of the covenant. They need to choose to do it so that they will do it willingly. The whole point of covenanting is that there be a willing exchange. Our obedience, God's blessings. All right, it should be tendered to none but such as are reformed from the defections and compliances of the times. Look at Nehemiah 10:28.
Nehemiah 10:28. And the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the porters, the singers, the Nethinims, and all they that had separated themselves from the people of the lands unto the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone having knowledge and having understanding.
Look very carefully what Nehemiah is saying here. There are a lot of Jews, and they don't cease to be Jews, who are in compliance with the times. But the only ones who are going to be taken into this covenant, this renewal of covenant, are those people who do so willingly and have separated themselves under the law of God. They're not going to live, and they're not going to be content to live according to the contemporary pattern. They're deliberately casting themselves out of conformity with that pattern. People who are in conformity with the times, with the contemporary practice, if that's the big concern, what people think and what people are doing now, that's out of step with what is being asked in order to enter into this covenant renewal. Right, as well, we see that it was tendered to none but to those who had knowledge and understanding of the sins and duties contained in the covenant. Again, it was tendered to none but such as can swear and subscribe it according to the qualifications of an oath. Jeremiah 4:2.
Jeremiah 4, verse 2. And thou shalt swear, the Lord liveth in truth, in judgment, and in righteousness, and the nation, and the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him they shall bless.
The people to whom this ought to be tendered are people who are entering into it willingly, who enter into it with what would be hoped to be at least some understanding. They're aware of what it is that's being required, both in the positive and the negative. They understand, on the one hand, they're being required to separate and abstain from the sins of the times in particular, as well as a general compliance with the moral law. On the other hand, there are positive duties that are being impressed upon those who would renew covenant. So we're looking for people in covenant renewal. We're looking that people are undergoing it willingly, with an understanding, both positive and negative, of what is going to be entailed upon them. And that such people are adjudged by competent authority to be people who are not either, they're not either wicked or scandalous in their own right, in an obstinate way. You know, we're all sinners. We're not talking about that. We're talking about people who are, beknownst to themselves, are actually engaged in or living in known sin and don't want to come out of it. Or those, on the other hand, who are positively, not just passively breaking the law of God, positively breaking the law of God to the point even perhaps of being in opposition to these covenants. Now, we're also saying this, just because you are disqualified, either you've disqualified yourself or competent authority has disqualified you from taking it, it does not mean you're not obliged to take it. What it means is you're obliged to get your life in line to the point where you'll be allowed to take it. You know, you can't just say, well, I can't come to the Lord's Supper, for example, because I'm behaving in a disorderly and wicked manner. and therefore I'm absolved from coming to the Lord's Supper. The answer isn't that. The answer is fix it so that you can come. Can't leave it hanging out there. So, the obligation is universal. But that obligation, though it's universal, does not mean that everyone is going to be fit to be admitted to it. They ought to be. They ought to conform themselves to what is expected to the degree that they would be or should be or could be. Question two. And I think this is not only a legitimate question for people to raise, but it's also very instructive in the reverse. If we consider this question and the negative from a negative point of view, which we're going to do at least in part here, I think it helps instill in us how serious a vow or a covenant really is. So question two, can anything loose the obligation of a lawful oath? And the answer is no. In all things considered, we have to say no. Look at Psalm 15:4.
Psalm 15, verse 4. In whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honoreth them that fear the Lord. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not.
Fact is that no man's temporal loss or prejudice will make an oath null or loose from the obligation of it. In other words, if you've entered into a lawful oath or vow, it does not matter how much you find that to be to your own prejudice or your own hurt. If you're under a vow, an oath, some sort of a covenanted arrangement, temporal loss or prejudice is not going to nullify it. You can't just say, well, you know I promised to do X, Y, or Z, but if I do it, it'll ruin me. If you promise to do X, Y, or Z, the prospect that it would ruin you, that's not enough to lose that obligation. We would go on to say that nor though the oath engages to something in its own nature indifferent. If you look at Numbers 30, verse 2.
Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth.
The fact is this, that an oath even with respect to things which are indifferent prior to the taking of the oath, the Bible teaches us that oath binds our soul. You know, we take something out of the realm of being indifferent sometimes when we take an oath or a vow. It's indifferent, for example, to a certain degree, who we marry. But once we've taken that oath or that vow, that's no longer an indifferent thing. We bound our souls. What was indifferent prior to the oath or vow is no longer a matter of indifference. Nor can the extortion of it by fear of violence, if the matter is lawful, nor the deceit and guile of others, if the deceit is only circumstantial, as in the oath to the Gibeonites, look at Joshua 9:3-13.
Joshua 9:3-13. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, they did work willingly and went and made as if they had been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles old and rent and bound up, and old shoes and clotted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal, and said unto him, and to the men of Israel, We be come from a far country, now therefore make ye a league with us. And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, Peradventure ye dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you? And they said unto Joshua, We are thy servants. And Joshua said unto them, Who are ye, and from whence come ye? And they said unto him, From a very far country thy servants are come, because of the name of the Lord thy God. For we have heard the fame of him, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites, that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spake to us, saying, Take victuals with you for the journey, and go to meet them, and say unto them, We are your servants, therefore now make ye a league with us. This our bread we took hot for our provision out of our houses on the day we came forth to go unto you. But now, behold, it is dry, and it is moldy. And these bottles of wine which we filled were new, and behold, they be rent. And these our garments and our shoes are become old by reason of the very long journey.
Okay, so the Gibeonites approach the Israelites. With all kinds of deceit. The entire approach is deceitful because they're really part of the Canaanites. They should be driven out of the land. But we have to remember that that is a circumstance. Who they are is the circumstance. The oath itself or the vow that they're going to enter into, that is materially, in and of itself, would have been a lawful thing to enter into. Had there not been this circumstantial command regarding disposition of the Canaanite people. So they've used deceit, but in the end, the covenant itself, the matter, that materially, it was in fact lawful. Circumstantially, it was not lawful, but here's where we see that unlawful circumstance cannot negate a covenant which for its matter is lawful. Even when the circumstance in this case was one that existed by the command of God. Because there's a matter of fundamental morality, there's a matter of substantive morality in the act of covenanting. The command to exterminate Canaanites is not a universal command for all times and all places. This is in part why a lot of these ceremonial laws and so on are able to be abolished under the New Testament. Same kind of rationale between a material substance and what is circumstantially brought into a moral service. Right, we can extend this a little further. We can say, nor will the sinful rashness in the manner of covenanting or taking an oath, if it is lawful in the matter. Again, Joshua 9, this time 14 and 15.
Joshua 9, verses 14 and 15. And the men took their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation sware unto them.
They entered into this covenant rashly. Right? Well, the Israelites. They didn't ask counsel of the Lord. The Gibeonites deceived them, which was a defect in the circumstance. They didn't tell the truth as to who they were. But in both cases, from both sides, the matter of the covenant was lawful. And because it was lawful, the deceit on the one side and the rashness on the other, neither one is enough to negate or overrule what is substantially or materially a moral, that is to say, a valid covenant or oath. All right. Beyond that, we can say, nor any good meaning or intention in reversing the oath. Look at 2 Samuel 21, 2.
2 Samuel 21, verse 2. The king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn unto them, and Saul sought to slay them in the seal to the children of Israel and Judah.
It doesn't really matter that you have a good meaning or intention. You can't reverse that oath. Could have had the best intention in the world. But that does not give him the right to override or overrule something which was materially lawful. And without defect. I mean, without defect as to the matter. It has defect as to circumstance. There's deceit. And there was rashness. All right. Nor though the oath be conceived by creatures. That is, when it's sworn to the creature rather than the creator. In Matthew 23, 20 and 22.
Whoso therefore shall swear by the altar, sweareth by it, and by all things thereon. Verse 22. And he that shall swear by heaven, sweareth by the throne of God, and by him that sitteth thereon.
It doesn't matter that you've sworn by the altar, you've sworn by heaven. If the matter of it is good, your ill-conceived direction in your swearing isn't going to get you out of it. The matter's lawful. Ultimately, every covenant is sworn as before God. Regardless of your defect, your spiritual defect. You know, there are a lot of heathens who think they're swearing to their gods. When they enter into an oath, doesn't matter. That oath is binding because it's materially good. That's why we recognize, for example, unlike the Roman Church, we recognize that marriage is valid amongst all who are, in fact, qualified to be married. You know, we don't recognize marriage in sodomites or in people who are in some way, other way, incapacitated from performing some of the inherent duties of marriage. But we don't restrict it to believers only. You know, they may be swearing. They may be taking an oath that is, in fact, as to their immediate direction. There may be a defect. Doesn't matter. Same thing when people take oaths to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in a court of law. And we're not saying they have to be believers to do it. Everybody's under this obligation. Just because you're a pagan doesn't mean you're not under the obligation to tell the truth. Nor does it mean that you are exempted from being asked to take an oath to tell the truth. Right? Nor when the things becomes impossible, if that impossibility could have been foreseen or prevented. In other words, it doesn't matter. If something becomes impossible, if you could have foreseen or prevented that impossibility, whatever made the oath impossible to fulfill, it's on you. It's one thing if it's entirely outside of your purview, which we'll talk about in a moment. But if it's something that should have been or could have been foreseen or even more prevented by you, and it's not, you can't then say, well, I no longer should owe this, for example. You know, I know I promised to pay this much money, but, you know, I blew all my money gambling. Now I can't pay that. I can't meet that obligation. It doesn't lessen your obligation. It doesn't let you out of it. Generally speaking, societies recognize that principle in things like contract law, which is really a form of covenant. We're saying that applies across the board. You know, you can't plead as an escape clause something that you could either have foreseen or prevented. You know, if you didn't foresee it or you didn't prevent it, your obligation remains is the same. All right, nor when the condition is unlawful if already fulfilled. Look at Genesis 38, 16 and 17.
And he turned unto her by the way and said, "Come to, I pray thee, let me come in unto thee." For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What wilt thou give me that thou mayest come in unto me?" And he said, "I will send thee a kid from the flock." And she said, "Wilt thou give me a pledge till thou send it?"
Now, that's, if you remember, that's that whole exchange here between Judah and Tamar. And that exchange was inherently unlawful. However, if you have entered into a covenant, the condition of which was unlawful, but you've already fulfilled that unlawful condition, you're already beyond that, can't undo that. What was lawful beyond that, that is in Judah's case, the payment for services rendered, you owe it. Which is to say that basically, in any case, now, had you said, "Well, no, that, as we'll see in a moment, that was unlawful, I shouldn't have entered into it," if the condition hasn't been fulfilled, that's one thing. But once the condition is fulfilled, there's no backing out. You can't lose that obligation. You should have thought before you fulfilled the unlawful obligation. You know, the unlawful obligation was your sin. But your sin in this does not take away what is lawful materially with respect to the oath. Now, Tamar's prostituting herself was unlawful. Judah's taking her up on it was unlawful. But once the condition, that is, the act had transpired, the covenant for the payment, well, materially that was lawful. And he's required to pay. If he didn't, he he's guilty before God for that. Now, they're both guilty for what they've done. But he's going to add another layer or level of guilt. Anybody who thinks that, you know, Christian ethics or casuistry, biblical casuistry, is just always a straight line, hasn't taken the time to sit down and think some of these things through. Some of these things are difficult to conceive of, you know, which is why we go over this stuff. It's not something that would initially perhaps suggest itself to you, but this is exactly why in the matter of covenanting, we need to make sure everything going on is right all the way through, including everything leading up to entering into the covenant. Nor another meaning devised afterwards, not according to the imposer's mind, nor our own at first who took it. It's Psalm 24, 4.
Psalm 24, verse 4. He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully.
The fact is this, if we've entered into a covenant, if we've taken a vow, a vow or a covenant is entered into and is to be taken in the sense of the one imposing that vow or covenant. You can't take a covenant. You can't say yes to a covenant in your own sense. Like, this is really something that the Jesuits were very famous for doing. They were willing to practice what they called mental reservation. They would say yes in taking an oath or a vow when mentally they kept back a little reserve back here and somewhere in their brain. Nah, I'm not really doing that. So you think if you're imposing the vow, they've taken it. But they have taken it in their own sense, which is not really taking it. So they really don't have to tell the truth. For example. Because when they took the vow, they weren't really understanding it that way. We're not at liberty to do that in oaths and vows, and especially having entered into it, all of a sudden now, to try to do some sort of mental gymnastics in order to avoid the clear intent of the covenant, that's just legal wrangling. It's covenant breaking, and you're not allowed to do that. You have no right to come up with some other meaning. You know, like we both understood when the vow was taken or the covenant was made, we both understood what that meant. Now, one or both parties are going to try to change course? No, you can't do that. You're not at liberty to do that, biblically. Now, oaths have no force, first of all, when the thing sworn is sinful and unlawful in itself. Look at Acts 23:21.
Acts 23:21. But do not thou yield unto them, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath, that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now are they ready, looking for a promise from thee.
I hear a bunch of people who have bound themselves with an oath to do what? To kill Paul. Is that a legitimate oath or vow? No. Because materially, what they're vowing to do is wrong. They're vowing to commit murder. That's an oath or a vow that has no force. It doesn't matter. People will say, well, you know, I made this promise. I have to keep it. Really? The first thing you need to ask yourself is, was it a promise to do something sinful or unlawful in itself? If it is, you didn't have a right to enter into that. It was a sin to enter into it. In the first instance, it would be a sin altogether, all over again, to follow through. You didn't have that right. I've known a number of people who have said to me at various times, you know, I made this promise or that promise, and now I just have to do it, even though they know it's wrong. No, you don't. It was wrong to make the promise. It'd be doubly wrong to follow through with the promise. Better simply to say, you know, I was wrong to make the promise. I can't keep that promise. It would be wrong all over again. There's no oath or vow to be broken because there was none that could be made. There was nothing there materially to be made. You can't really make an oath or a vow to God to do something contrary to his command, his law. All right. Second, it has no force. Oaths have no force, or when the thing sworn to is unlawful to him that swears it. Look at Mark 6, 22 and 26.
Mark 6, verse 22. And when the daughter of the said Herodias came in and danced and pleased Herod and them that sat with him, the king said unto the damsel, ask of me whatsoever thou wilt, and I will give it thee. In verse 26. And the king was exceeding sorry, yet for his oath's sake and for their sakes which sat with him, he would not reject her.
Yeah. John the Baptist is beheaded because the king makes an oath that he's unwilling to rescind. Now, the king has the power to execute people, undoubtedly. He has the power of the sword. But he does not have the power of the sword to execute people simply in order to please some lover or paramour, you know, to get some female's attention. That's not enough. That's not a real, it's still unlawful. Even though he's allowed to execute people, he's not allowed to execute anybody for any reason. So the thing sworn to was unlawful for him that swore it. He shouldn't have done it. He wasn't bound to do it. There was no binding. It was a double sin. It was a sin that he swore to do it. It was a sin that he actually carried it out. First, he perjured himself before God in taking such an oath, and then he committed murder. Right? Oaths have no force when the thing sworn is simply impossible. Look at Matthew 5:36.
Matthew 5:36. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black.
Now I know with the advent of hair dyes and all of that, people think that they can, but the Bible speaking in absolute terms, you're really not doing it, you're just hiding it. You're not making one hair white or black, it is what it is, you're just hiding it. The fact is, you can't swear because by these sorts of things because they're not within your power. It's impossible for you to do. You know, I can't go out and swear that I'm going to lift a boulder the size of Colorado. You know, it's an impossibility for me. You swear to something which is simply impossible. There is no oath. You know, if I swear that I'm going to give someone $1 million, I've sworn to do that which is impossible for me. Unless I've given the proviso, that is, if I ever have $1 million. In which case, then I may find myself bound to do it one day. But we don't have a right to make an oath or a vow to do what is impossible. In a sense, it's actually just simply a glorified lie. All right, fourth, we don't have a right, there's no oath in force when the thing sworn is sworn to do is not in our power. Look at Numbers 30, verses 5 and 14.
Numbers 30, verse 5. But if her father disallow her in the day that he heareth, not any of her vows or of her bonds wherewith she hath bound her soul shall stand, and the Lord shall forgive her because her father disallowed her. And verse 14. But if her husband altogether hold his peace at her from day to day, that he establisheth all her vows and all her bonds, which are upon her, he confirmeth them, because he hath held his peace in her, at her in the day that he heard them.
In these cases in Numbers, in the case of the daughter, the case of the wife, they don't have the final say in their own lives in this situation, but if they swear and then upon hearing it, the father or the husband negates it, they're free from that. But if the father or the husband confirm it, then they're bound. There's no in between. You know, you can't swear to do something that's not in your power. You can't swear in an abstract way. For example, I can't swear to turn off Hoover Dam. It's not in my power. If it was in my power and I swore, I'd have to do it. But I can't swear to do something which is not in my power. No one has a right to do that. And I can't swear something that's going to force your hand unless you're under my authority. In which case, then you have to suck it up. You, on the other hand, can't swear to do anything in your power. Abstractly considered, if you're under the authority of another without their concurring authority. You know, that's the whole point in a nation of an ambassador. An ambassador can't go out and say, well, you know, I'm going to sign this treaty and I'm going to sign that treaty. It doesn't work that way if you don't have the authority of the president or the prime minister or whatever. You can't, an ambassador can't just go out and act on his own behalf. So there are different ways in which things are outside of your power. However that falls out, if it's outside of your power, you just don't have the authority. Right, fifth. Oaths have no force when the deceit in it is not in the circumstantials, but in the essentials. Look at
Matthew 19:9. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery.
Yeah, there's an issue of fidelity in marriage that is essential to a marriage. And Jesus is saying, look, circumstantial deceit and circumstances, that's not enough to put an end to that vow or that covenant, to bring it to an end. This is why we, you know, the Reformed churches allow divorce, but divorce is only allowable when essentials have been violated with respect to that oath, when there's been fornication or adultery detected. That's when it's allowed. You know, had the Gibeonites had that vow with the Israelites been materially defective, it wouldn't have been an oath that would have been of any force. Their deceit was only circumstantial. We didn't really know who they were. But what they were covenanted to do and to be, well, there was no defect in that. Essentially, that was okay. But had it not been, instead of hewers of wood and drawers of water, they had been covenanted to do something immoral, that contrary to the natural moral law, for example, contracted to be murderers, that wouldn't have stood. There'd be an oath of no force. All right? When oaths are of no force, when they hinder a greater good. Look at Mark 7:11-13.
Mark 7, verses 11-13.
But you say, if a man shall say to his father or mother, it is Corban, that is to say, a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free. If you suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother, making the word of God of none effect through your traditions, which ye have delivered, many such like things do ye.
Imagine that. Imagine being able to have some oath or vow. Corban, it is Corban means it's devoted. That is, I've taken an oath. Oh, so your oath to devote something to God that was indifferent, that takes precedent over the command to honor your father and mother. Jesus says, no, can't do that. You can't have an oath that's going to hinder a greater good. You know, I can't say, well, I promised not to tell. You know, and then we find out that they're killing millions of Jews in that concentration camp. You know, that oath not to tell, under other circumstances, may have been a justified oath and would have been binding. But if it's hindering some greater good, it's hiding or keeping back something from being called out and being addressed, some greater good coming from it, then there's really no force in that oath. You can't make that a pretext for allowing some evil to occur. All right, seventh, when the case materially alters. Look at Matthew 26:15.
Matthew 26:15. And said unto them, what will ye give me, and I will deliver him unto you? And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver.
Yeah, now going back to, you know, him doing that was unlawful. Okay, but having once done it, do they own the 30 pieces of silver? Yeah, they do. But if the case materially altered, that is, something, you know, you covenanted for, to, you contracted to do this or that for this much, and then somebody changes the terms on either side. You know, the person receiving is saying, no, I'm going to give you less, or the person after doing whatever, delivering whatever, says, no, I want more. That oath is not in effect. You can't, you know, you're in the process of a violation. It's, the oath is out of force. You can't do that. When there's some material alteration, it's very much like the case of Jacob with Leah and Rebecca, Rachel, with Leah and Rachel. That there's a deceit, right? I mean, the case altered materially. And Jacob should have put his foot down a little bit there. So wait a minute. There's no oath or covenant in view here when we had this other agreement. You know, he went the extra mile, if you will, with Laban. Or eight, when the party sworn to relaxes us. That is to say, when you've have some oath, but the party to whom the oath has been sworn says, don't worry about it. John 5:8-11.
Jesus saith unto him, rise, take up thy bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made whole, and took up his bed, and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, it is the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. He answered them, he that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed, and walk.
Yeah, what his answer is really this. Look, he's saying God He's recognizing the deity because he's saying, you know, God is the one who imposed the Sabbath, but God is also the one telling me to take my bed and walk. He's bound me to this, but he relaxed it in this case. Take up your bed and walk. You know, if you are in some situation with an oath or a vow, and the other party to whom you've made this oath or vow, they relax that, then you're free. You know, you promise to do X, Y, or Z. But it's going to be a real hardship for you. You don't have a right to relax yourself and say, I can't do it. Remember, you should have foreseen that. That was your improvidence that brought you to that. You know, you could have prevented that, perhaps. But if the other party is willing to relax that and release you, then the oath or the vow is no longer in effect. Now, we have to ask ourselves, some oaths and vows, you know, this does not pertain to things like, for example, marriage. You don't have a right to relax that oath or that vow and let the other person go. It's not in your power to do that. Can't just say, well, it'd be better for all of us if we just parted ways. It's not in your power to do that. You don't have the right to do that. Because your oath and vow in that case is not simply to one another, it's to God. So we have to be very careful about this idea of relaxing and asking ourselves, is there another party involved? All right, question three. What better are we for the making, keeping of such covenants? And the answer is, by such means we're established a people unto God, and he promises to be unto such a God, as he said and sworn, which comprehends all advantages imaginable. Look at Deuteronomy 29:13.
That he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he hath said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.
So covenanting establishes a people unto God, and it all the benefits accrue to the people of God if they're obedient. We are better. It's a gauge. It tells us something about ourselves. It tells us something, helps us gauge our relation with respect to God. But the final question, question four, is the obligation of national covenants, where the matter is lawful, perpetual, and binding upon posterity? And the answer is yes. I mean, if any engagements can be supposed binding to posterity, certainly national covenants to keep the commandments of God and adhere to his institutions must be of that nature. It's not to be denied that several obligations do bind posterity. First of all, for example, public promises with annexation of curses to breakers make the posterity obnoxious as well as those who personally came under the engagement. Look at Nehemiah 5:12-13.
Nehemiah 5:12-13. Then said they, we will restore them and will require nothing of them. So will we do as thou sayest. Then I called the priests and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise. Also, I shook my laugh and said, so God shake out every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise. Even thus be he shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said, amen, and praise the Lord. And the people did according to this promise.
Yeah, I mean, this is a public promise made with a curse attached. People say amen. It's binding. Binding on posterity. Thus did that promise of the Jewish nobles and rulers bring their posterity under the curse if they had exacted usury of their brethren. So too did Joshua's adjuration oblige all posterity never to build Jericho. Look at Joshua 6:26.
Joshua 6:26. And Joshua adjured them at that time, saying, cursed be the man before the Lord
that riseth up and buildeth this city Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it.
And the breach of that adjuration, the covenant, brought a curse upon Hiel the Bethelite in the days of Ahab. 1 Kings 16:34.
1 Kings 16:34. In his days did Hiel the Bethelite build Jericho. He laid the foundation thereof in Abram, his firstborn, and set up the gates thereof in his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by Joshua, the son of Nun.
So, hundreds of years later, this public promise that was acknowledged by all the people at that time, the curse annexed to it, was in fact brought to pass. Now that couldn't be if it wasn't obliging. If the promise and the curse annexed to it, if they weren't obliging. Right, second, public vows do bind posterity. Look at Jacob's vow in Genesis 28:20.
Genesis 28:20. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on.
The fact is that it did oblige all posterity, virtually comprehended in him, if we look at Hosea 12:4.
Hosea 12:4. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us.
Found him in Bethel. What did he do? He made a vow. He spake to us, what, in Hosea's time. There's a perpetuity. That vow is perpetually binding on the posterity. Right, the Rechabites found themselves obliged to observe the vow of their forefather Jonadab. Look at Jeremiah 35:6-14.
Jeremiah 35:6. But they said, we will drink no wine. For Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father commanded us, saying, ye shall drink no wine, neither ye nor your sons forever. In verse 14, the words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, that he commanded his sons not to drink wine, or performed, for unto this day they drink none, but obey their father's commandment. Notwithstanding, I have spoken unto you, rising early and speaking, but ye hearkened not unto me.
So in that case, they're commended for that. Jeremiah uses them as an example. They understood themselves to be bounded by that covenant, that vow. Right. Third, public oaths do oblige posterity. Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel to carry up his bones to Canaan. Genesis 50:25.
Genesis 50:25. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and he shall carry up my bones from hence.
And that did oblige the posterity hundreds of years afterward. Look at Exodus 13:19 and Joshua 24:32.
Exodus 13:19. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straightly sworn to the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and he shall carry up my bones away hence with you.
Joshua 24:32. And the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in a parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver. And it became the inheritance of the children of Joseph.
And fourth, we know that national covenants with men before God do oblige posterity. Such was Israel's covenant with the Gibeonites, which we've looked at before. Look again at Joshua 9:15-19.
Joshua 9:15. And Joshua made peace with them, and made a league with them, to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swore unto them. And verse 19. But all the princes said unto all the congregation, we have sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel. Now therefore we may not touch them.
And we know that the breach of that covenant many years later caused the posterity to be plagued. Look at 2 Samuel 21:1.
2 Samuel 21:1. Then there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, it is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites.
And we see the same with Zedekiah's covenant with Nebuchadnezzar in Ezekiel 17:18-19.
Ezekiel 17:18-19, seeing he despised the earth by breaking the covenant, when lo, he had given his hand hath done all these things. He shall not escape. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, as I live, surely mine oath that he hath despised, and my covenant that he hath broken, even it will I recompense upon his own head.
So, especially national covenants with God before men about things which are moral, which are objectively obliging, are perpetual. Look at Jeremiah 50, verse 5.
Jeremiah 50, verse 5. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces thitherward, saying, come, let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten.
So we can say that yet more are they perpetual and binding then when they're of a hereditary nature. That is, when the subject is permanent, the matter is moral, the end is good, and in the form of them there's a clause expressing their perpetuity. These covenants then are national. National covenants carry an obligation when the matter is lawful to a perpetual and binding, it's a perpetual and binding obligation upon posterity. And that's a standing presumption then in this that we're looking at with what they did at Arkansas. They understand that they're bound. They're bound as a nation. They're bound as a church. They're bound as covenanters. And that obligation is something they're going to carry with them wherever they go. And they understand that. At least in 1712, they understood that that was still the case. Right, we're going to continue next time with renovation of covenants, and we'll move on a little further in the preface.